Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and really pleased to welcome back Milwaukee-based gardening expert, TV host, and author Melinda Meyer. She has 30 years of hort experience. She's written over 20 gardening books. She hosts the nationally syndicated Melinda's Garden Moments segments, which air on TV and radio stations around the United States. Master's degree in horticulture, certified arborist, and was a horticulture instructor with tenure at one point as well. So great to have her back. And certainly as you listen in, have a question about your own garden, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And don't forget, you can go to our Facebook page as well, at The Larry Mueller Show, and post your comment, or maybe you've got a nice photograph you want to share with us that relates to gardening. Melinda Meyer is with us by phone. Hi, Melinda.
Good morning, Larry. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing good. The sun is shining. Oh, it feels like spring may actually be here, at least for today.
At least for one day. Yeah, it is just beautiful. It's hard to be inside on a day like today, that's for sure.
It certainly is.
Well, Sunday is Mother's Day. And I'm sure there are some sons and daughters and dads who are wondering, what should I get for mom on for Sunday? And here it is, Friday already. What gift ideas do you have for mothers that like to get their hands dirty in the garden?
Well, the good news is the garden centers are adding more and more plants every day as the, you know, spring is moving in. So if mom likes to garden, anything from the cool new plants that, you know, all gardeners can't resist. I had one master gardener tell me her best Mother's Day gift was a load of compost. You know, that's a true gardener. Tools are always good, and good quality tools. You know, you spend a little more, but they last forever. And I think that's kind of nice. And there's so many new designs out there that are a little more ergonomically correct, so they handle are adjusted so that you hold them with your wrist straight, so you really reduce that wear and the tiring and the risk of carpal tunnel. The other thing is a lot of garden centers and nature centers often have plant-related crafts for kids. I know Stein Garden Center here in southeast Wisconsin on Saturday from 10 to 2 has this free activity for kids, something you could probably do yourself too or take them. They're going to decorate little terracotta pots with thumbprints and then use markers, permanent markers, to make little animals and flowers, and then the kids can plant a flower. You know, I know as a mom, and I don't know if you have those things, but yeah. I had a watering can my daughter made. She cut out flowers, decoupaged it on this plastic watering can 20 years ago, and I still have it on a shelf, and it just makes me smile when I think about it. And so you might want to, you know, if your kids want to do something homemade, you can relate it to gardening very easily, or let them pick out the plant. And it may not be the one you want, but you know what? They probably have a reason for picking out that certain color or that certain kind of flower. You know, let them pick out a container. Last year, I had an auntie who brought the kids, her friends, her nieces, to the garden center where I was working, and they, I helped them pick out. You know, they picked out pots, and we put some flowers together and talked about what mom liked to eat. So we put a few veggies in with some flowers. And, you know, it was a fun day for the aunt with her nieces, and I'm sure that mom was just thrilled
about
her planters that she could enjoy all season. So, you know, plants are good. Think about growing conditions. Think about what mom likes to do. My mom is not a gardener, so cut flowers are what she gets every year from me. Me, I'm liking plants and cut flowers and tools. So anybody listening out there, my daughter, if you're listening, honey, any of those would be good.
All right. And some great ideas there. You know, you mentioned garden centers, and we got an email from Mary in Washington County, and she wonders if there's been any research to verify the validity of soil tests that you can buy at a garden center. Do these kits do just as well as the extension test?
Well, I'm going to tell you, I do have my roots in extension and science, and I'm a big believer that you spend a little extra money and you go to a state-certified lab. I think they can give you a snapshot, but my book, if you're going to spend the money, get really good results. The state labs, if they're certified by the states, they have samples that have been documented. Here's the, you know, phosphorus, potassium, the pH, and they test the equipment so they know it's calibrated and the chemicals being used. The kits in the garden center, you know, it's a starting point, but you don't know how they've been handled in shipment and the calibration, mm-hmm. and then it leaves a lot of things up to you and your water and how you handle it. So my feeling is when I test my soil, I let the experts do it. And, you know, they have the equipment and the expertise. And then they can also make recommendations based on these nutrients, this rating, pH, your soil, and this is what you want to grow. Here's the recommended fertilization. And really, you end up saving the money because quite often we tend to overdo.
Right.
You know, if a little's good, more is better. Well, I don't know what to put, so I'll just put this down. And sometimes you may be surprised if you've done a lot of composting and adding organic matter. You know, you'll need to do very little fertilizing if your soil's in good shape.
Absolutely. Well, Marilyn in Montfort has a question for you, Melinda. So let's go to Marilyn. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello. I'm right out in my garden right now, working in my herb garden. But it's my strawberry bed that I'm concerned about. I have a raised bed, and I didn't, the soil wasn't the best. And it's been about 3 years, and I'm thinking I really wish I had changed the soil out. And I wondered, could I dig up the strawberries, change the soil, and replant them? Is that something I could do now?
Okay, well, a couple things. Depending on how you train your strawberries, if you let the runners go, and so you have rows of strawberries and then train the runners to then take over and then eventually till up the original plants, one good benefit of managing them that way is when you get rid of the original plants to make room for all the runners you've trained, that's a great time to amend the soil. So when the runners send out runners into the area you've amended, basically what you're doing is you're creating different pathways, you're renovating your soil a little bit at a time, and that way you can still keep productivity going. Digging up and amending the soil is a possibility. You'll impact your fruit production this year, but in the long run you'll see improvement. So, you know, if you do have runners going, you may want to either let those go and then fix the soil and then move the plantlets from this year. Or you decide, you know what, the production's so bad anyway, it's a good time to start over. And, you know, if you're not happy with the variety you picked, that might also be a good thing to do, too, and say, you know what, I'm going to get an Everbearing or I'm going to change out my variety. Extension has a great publication. In fact, Larry, I always try to pull them up because the benefit of being in my house is I have them in front of me. But Extension has some really good publication on fruit cultivars for southern and then a separate one for northern Wisconsin. And it's always a good place to start to look at if you're putting new additions in, to start there with those recommendations.
Well, thank you.
All right.
Okay, good luck and enjoy. What a great day you have for gardening.
Oh, it's perfect. Thank you very much for calling, Marilyn. Appreciate your call. We have an email from Diana and Cable. Last year, I purchased two hanging baskets of tuberous begonias. They bloomed continuously and profusely all summer. In the fall, I was going to dig the bulbs and store them until this spring, but lo and behold, there weren't any bulbs. Is there a way in which begonias are being propagated so they don't have a bulb, or what could have happened to the bulb?
You know, the nonstop tuberous begonias are started from seed. They do develop a tuberous stem, and you want to make sure that you did have a tuberous begonia because there's lots of new begonias out on the market. The angel wing and some of those that don't look like our typical wax begonia but don't form that tuberous stem. So one, it might be one of the new ones that isn't truly a tuberous begonia. What I find with sometimes with some of those plants that form tuberous stems, if they've been in soggy conditions or not quite ideal, they may not develop a good tuberous stem. The other thing that you may want to try with the wax begonias, even the tuberous stem begonias, is if you have room, bring the plant indoors and grow it as a house plant in a sunny window. I've met gardeners who've done this for 4 or 5 years with that plant to keep it going. Find it a little easier than storing the tuberous root. But then if you don't have room, I'm looking around. I'm sitting in my office at home, which is full of plants that, you know, it starts with one, right, Larry? You bring... Got to bring that pomegranate in it. Well, if I'm bringing that in, I'll bring this Mandevilla, and then all of a sudden it's like, what was I thinking? So that's the benefit of storing those tuberous stems and peat moss in a cool, dark place. So, it sounds like if your plants are doing fine, you did everything right. Fertilization and hanging baskets, a balanced fertilizer is usually beneficial, or something for flowering plant. A fertilizer or even a low nitrogen, slow release like Milorganite will do well because it's little bits over time. But, you know, you might want to just check your fertilization. But again, it might have just been the variety you were growing.
There you go. Let's go to Beth in La Crosse next. Hi, Beth.
Hi. I appreciate the information. I'm just starting to be a gardener up here. I had the longest climbing roses I've ever seen across the country. But in the north, I'm having some trouble. I have a beautiful rose, which I believe is climbing rose in the front. I fertilized it last year. I don't know nearly as much about gardening as you all do, I can tell. And I've been cutting back the little dead stems in the autumn, and now it's getting tall. I'm getting runners up 7 or 8 feet, and it's getting more prolific, but I'm not getting a lot of roses. Could you please help me?
Great question, and I'm so glad you asked. Where did you move from?
Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you guys are a little milder. The summers will be a little less brutal. Hold that thought, right?
Yes.
With climbing roses, a couple of things. Climbing roses very often are grafted. So let's say you have a Tropicana rose, and they found one that produced these long stems, and they'll graft it onto a hardy rootstock and then grow it. So if your graft dies, you know, typically we plant the graft below the soil surface, add some insulation for winter. If that graft dies, the rootstock often sends up stems that tend to be a bigger space between the leaves and then more thorns and no flowers, or flowers different from what you purchased.
Yes.
If that's what you're seeing, the graft probably died. The other thing that can happen with climbing roses is many of them bloom on old wood, older stems. So if those stems die back over winter, you'll get new growth, but it won't bloom. So that's why you'll often see northern gardeners bending their climbing roses over and burying them, or you know, wrap them in burlap filled with, I know, it's sounding awful, isn't it, filled
with
straw?
No, it's good.
But there are a few that tend to be a little more hardy in this area. Mm-hmm. New Dawn, D-A-W-N, like the morning dawn or the
Thank
girl's
you.
Name.
Mm-hmm.
4th of July. They've had good luck at in the Green Bay area with those making it over winter.
Yes.
With no protection. I've gone an even easier route, and I've used the Canadian explorers like William Baffin. And it's a shrub rose, but it's really big, and you can treat it like a climber. It is really big, so you need to give it a little room. But it's upright. It blooms kind of a rosy pink flower, rest, and then blooms again. And I don't do anything to mine other than I need to get out there right now this afternoon and prune off. Thin it out a bit because it's doing a little too well for the space I have it in. But that one's hardy. You don't need to do anything but occasionally remove the older stems. And if you don't mind, I'm going to take advantage of your question. For people with climbing roses, the only pruning we do in spring, don't prune it in fall. Do whatever winter protection you choose to do. And then in spring, remove any dead canes right to the ground. Any fat older canes on old established plants, if you need to, leave the rest stand. And then it's going to usually bloom, and then you can do some shaping as needed. Hopefully you'll get repeat bloom, depending on the variety. So that's the best way to prune to ensure you have flowers.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
You are very welcome, and welcome to Wisconsin. Now,
yes.
Winters may be tougher, but, boy, summers can't be beat here.
Thanks, Beth. Thank you very much for calling. Melinda Myers, our guest today here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have Melinda Myers with us today on this edition of Garden Talk, and thank you for listening in. Call in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Pam in Gladstone, Michigan has a question for you, Melinda, so let's go there to Pam. Hi, Pam.
Hi, Pam.
Pam, are you there? Ah, we must
decide to go out and garden instead of wait.
I guess so. Let's go to Helen in Milwaukee next. Helen, hello to you.
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Good.
My question or problem is, we had a neighbor who had planted a trumpet vine along a fence next to a tree, which ultimately killed the tree, and so it's been taken down. But we planted some squash in our side of the yard, and this is last year, and it grew beautifully, and it was flowering, and we had several nice squash, and all of a sudden the stems turned black, and everything just dried up. My question is, what was that? And then can we plant tomatoes in that spot this year?
Okay, good question. Typically, I'm going to name a couple things that it might have been with the squash. Typically, when I hear about wilting, usually not a black stem, but usually you see a little like sawdust-like frass droppings from squash vine borer. And it's a black and orange day-flying moth that lays its eggs at the base of squash. The eggs hatch. The larva burrows into the stem and eats its way. And it seems like all of a sudden your squash just suddenly wilts. If you slice through the stem, you could actually find that borer. I like growing squash on trellises, but the downside is if you get squash vine borer, one of the cures is to slice the stem, leaving the roots intact, killing the borer, covering the damaged part with moist soil, and hopefully your squash is rooted in along the way or will, and often it will recover enough to produce squash. Anthracnose typically causes irregular brown spots on the leaves, and then you can get some drying of the stems. You know, nothing turning black other than a root rot like Rhizoctonia or Spythium or something like that, which is a general problem. Nothing else comes to mind. Do you have any black? You don't have any black walnuts, you or your neighbors?
Oh, no.
Okay, that's good.
No, that's good.
That's real good news.
We left those at our daughter's house. Okay.
Yeah, let her deal with it. I like that. Your tomatoes, typically, you know, your idea is right to follow different crops. So things that attack squash and the members of that family typically don't attack members sometimes of other families. So doing like squash followed by tomatoes, then followed by onions, followed by, you know, unrelated plants each year is a great way to rotate your crops and reduce pest problems. If it was root rot, and we had so much flooding, followed by drought, followed by flooding last year, it was a crazy growing season. It may have been rot as a result of our crazy weather. I mean, you couldn't control things even if you were watering because of the excess many of us had. So make sure your soil, you know, add some compost, you know, an activated compost like a purple cow or something to help improve the drainage. If you did have any flooding, that will also help improve the overall tilt and health of the soil before you plant your tomatoes. But typically, without knowing for sure what the disease was, typically following like you're doing is a great way to reduce problems.
There you go.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, and good luck with your garden this year.
Thank you very much for calling. Nancy in Heartland is going to be buying some hanging flower baskets this afternoon.
All right.
What can I buy that the deer won't eat, she says.
Oh, man, I'll tell you. Dr. Laura Jahl with UW Extension put together a brochure on deer-resistant plants, and it's on. You can visit that and get that off the website. I'll tell you a couple of things to keep in mind. If there are a lot of deer and they're hungry enough, they will eat anything.
Anything.
You know, every plant I've seen on a list, especially flower-wise, I have seen them munch on. What you may want to do is, I know this sounds kind of crazy, but it helps with birds, too, is put some bird netting around your hanging baskets initially. And the idea is if the deer come and it's difficult for them to eat, they maybe will go to that neighbor that you don't like, of course.
Mm-hmm.
That's one you do, and go down the block and find another source of food. Using repellents is also a possibility. You know, you want to make sure that, you know, read and follow label directions. Some use taste, some use smell, you know, natural products. They did some research at the University of Connecticut in the horticulture department and found that Bob X, which is a natural product, was the most effective, other than a fence, and that we know is the best, but not always practical. But if you spray repellents, whatever brand you choose, do it before they start eating. You know, you'll need to repeat as growth, you know, new growth occurs. But if you do it before they start eating, often it's easier. They'll go, ooh, yuck, and go somewhere else too. The spray thing, motion-sensitive sprayers have proved to be pretty effective as well. You know, they walk in front of the motion sensor and a blast of water hits them. Mm-hmm. The biggest complaint I get is gardeners forgetting to turn them off when they're gardening. And I can see my neighborhood kids. Luckily, I don't have deer here in the city where I live, but I can see the kids dancing in the sprinklers in the summer. You know, I don't know how you feel, Larry, but I don't even want to start that list because I know if I mention one flower, there'll be a ton of people going, they ate that too. They do love phlox. I can give you some of their favorites. They do love phlox. So I'd avoid the baskets with the annual phlox. Angelonia is pretty new. It's the summer snapdragon. I'm seeing a lot of that in the landscape. I haven't heard a lot of reports, and it may just be because it's relatively new. Typically, petunias are in the Solanaceae family, but I'll know, which is tomatoes and peppers. I know they'll sometimes take bites out of those members. You may have some luck. I also had someone say, no, they ate theirs. So, you know, I just think it's, I think trying some other strategies rather than counting on them not liking them. And if anyone out there has plants that they feel are surefire, I'd love to hear from them. So,
all right, let's go to Pam in Gladstone, Michigan. I think we've got her this time.
Good. Hi, Pam.
Hi. I saw you speak at the gardening conference in Escanaba.
You know, I was hoping you were one. I'll tell you, Larry, I think northern gardeners are the best, and the folks in the UP have always been very hospitable and a lot of fun. I think the further north we go, the crazier we are as gardeners, right, Pam?
Sure. Well, I have a question about hibiscus.
Okay.
I bought a couple of those tall ones with the braided stems.
Oh, okay.
About a month ago from one of those big box, membership places.
Right.
And they looked beautiful when I bought them. They were intended for Mother's Day gifts. And within a week or so, they started dropping leaves, and I was watering them frequently like they told me to in the store, and I was keeping them in as sunny a spot as I had in my house. Well, anyway, now they kind of look like Charlie Brown's Christmas tree, and I'm going to be shopping for something else for Mother's Day gifts. But I'm hoping I can keep them to live anyway. So do you have any ideas? I was wondering if I should repot them or what I should do.
You know, good question, and I'm sure you're not alone. And one of the problems when we get the tropical hibiscus with the braided stems, are typically grown outdoors in areas like Florida, sometimes under shade cloth, but then they ship them up here, so hopefully they haven't spent too much time on the truck or the loading dock where it can be cold. Sometimes cold damage shows up later, but most likely what happens is that we have them, they've been growing outside in great sunlight, we bring them indoors, and like you said, the sunniest window, still not as good as outdoor sunlight, especially in Florida this time of year. And so they're acclimating. And so what they do often is they drop their leaves because they're not getting enough light. And then as long as the stems are pliable, keep them in that sunny area until you can move them out. The danger frost has passed and the days are reliably warm and nights as well. Water thoroughly, let them just go, keep them slightly moist. But if you keep them in a sunny window, continue to water, leave them in the same size pot, don't fertilize until they produce new leaves and are actively growing. Just, you know, patience is your best thing. I'm sure you can bring them back as long as those branches are pliable. Not by Mother's Day, unfortunately,
no.
But you'll have a couple of nice hibiscus for your patio. So just keep them as indoors. Treat them like a houseplant. You should start seeing some new growth soon. And then when you move them out, just like you move things from a greenhouse outdoors, gradually reintroduce them to the bright, sunny conditions if they've already started putting on leaves.
There you go, Pam. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling.
Thanks for joining me. I had such a fun weekend up in Escanaba. It was great.
Kathy in Verona has a question for you. Melinda, let's go to Kathy. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Mel. I used to walk down the hall to get answers from you.
Oh, well, hi. How are you?
But I'm so happy when you're on WPR.
Well,
so
thank you so much.
I now have a dilemma.
Okay.
My daughter lives north of Atlanta, and she's always asking for rhubarb. Well, we don't always go down there when it's a good time to pick rhubarb, but my idea is maybe I should just send her plants. A Wisconsin seed company says that Valentine rhubarb can grow in zones 3 to 8.
Right.
Now, 8 is the upper half of Atlanta.
Right.
So when would be a good time to send those down there?
Well, I would say whenever you can get a hold of the plants, get them down there. They're already pretty actively growing down in Georgia. I was lucky enough to speak at Epcot a week or so ago, and boy, they were harvesting red tomatoes in Orlando. I was very jealous. But,
Wow. Yeah,
so she's probably already getting started. So when you can get the plants, I would send them down. That's going to be your big limiting factor. The other thing, and I just want to throw this out, Kathy, in case others might be interested. Sometimes what our kids want or what we're looking for as gardeners is a piece of the family tradition. And if you did want to dig and divide your rhubarb at the right time, I like doing that early spring just as growth is beginning. They're really popping right now. And pot it up and then take it whenever you go or ship it. I had received some plants that were really well packaged. They put the root system, pot and all, in a baggie, tied it around the base of the plant, loosely, tied it, put it in cardboard, but then had a little form to wedge it in the bottom so that it was really held upright. But if you order it from somebody that does mail order, they know how to ship it. And I would just say, I would put your order in now so she can get it in the ground. The other time is fall, and the South is a great time for planting because you avoid the heat of the summer. But you may not be able to find plants to mail as easily. So I would say as soon as you can get a plant, I'd get it down to her so that she can get it in and get it established before it gets too hot.
Now, reading on the Internet, people were saying that it should go, like, on the north side, so it will maybe be cooler there in the winter.
Well,
but it still needs full sun.
I would say an east location would be better because you'll get the morning sun, you'll get that good 6 or 8 hours, but you'll have protection from the afternoon sun. So good point. She may want to look at her landscape, and it will take heat pretty well, but that's pretty humid too, so it's hot and humid. So I'd say a place where it gets a little break from afternoon sun would be great. So she may have to look at her landscape depending on how her house is situated and her neighbors' homes and her trees. Finding that location where she can get good morning sun that tends to be cooler and protection from the hot afternoon sun or midday and getting morning and afternoon light. Good things to consider.
Thanks, Kathy, for calling. Appreciate it very much. You mentioned Epcot at Disney, and I tell you, this time of year, it's kind of a fun time to visit there with the flowers.
Oh, it is. And, it's just so amazing because that change out happens when we're all sleeping.
Yeah.
And it is like magic. And the things they do, all the characters. I was speaking at their flower. I think the International Flower Festival goes through the middle of May.
Yeah.
So if you're heading that direction next week, you have time. But beautiful displays, like you said, the floating islands of flowers, the topiaries.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Oh, just incredible.
Lynn in Lake Forest, Illinois, has a question for you. Hi, Lynn.
Oh, hi, Larry, and hi, Melinda, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have another rhubarb question.
Okay.
Last year, a neighbor gave me was dividing her rhubarb plants and gave me a couple of them, which, since we the words sunny and well-drained do not go together in our yard, we stuck in containers.
Oh, excellent.
And they came up again, much to my amazement. And I am wondering, because I have not had this experience before, when they are very exuberant, very leafy, and is it too early to harvest some of the stalks?
Typically we always say wait a second year to let them get established, but I can just feel you got the need for a pie. if they're really exuberant, maybe a light harvest. And the benefit of being in a container, if it came back from winter, great. You control the moisture and the nutrients better. A light harvest, you'd be okay. I wouldn't do the whole 8 to 10 weeks like we do on an established plant. Typically,
okay,
the first year we like to do no harvest, the second year a few weeks, the third year full force. But, if your plant's looking good, if you picked a few stems here and there,
Maybe make a sauce or something, you know.
Yeah. And then right before the frost, you could do a full harvest then, as long as they haven't been nipped by the cold. Did you sink your container in the ground for winter and then dig it up, or?
You know, they weathered the winter, and we had plenty of snow around the plant.
Right.
But the only place we have are these containers that are at the edge of a little driveway apron, which gets more sun than other areas of the yard. And I'm looking around now for places that they might be transplanted. And that's my other question. When is the best time to transplant them?
You know, I'm a spring transplanter. I like to dig, divide, and transplant in spring. If you're putting them from the container intact in the ground, any time would work. And then fall is another time that a lot of rhubarb growers will do their digging and dividing, getting them reestablished before winter sets in. Rhubarb's pretty tough, as you found out. And, you know, if it's working in the container, you might want to have a few backup plants in the garden.
That's what you're thinking.
again, amend, adding organic matter to the soil, a compost, you know, some kind of organic matter that helps improve drainage, would, you know, help loosen that clay soil. I understand that whole heavy clay thing. And I've seen rhubarb do okay in part sun. It just isn't as prolific, so you need to adapt your harvesting based on the fact it's not going to do as well.
Well, I have a feeling that the good drainage is better, is more important than even, you know, full sun. And at least at this time of year, the deciduous trees aren't fully leafed out.
Right. So you get a good burst of nutrient replenishing, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And I think, you know, I think it's fun to grow stuff in containers, too. And it's always, you could dress it up with a few flowers around the edge and make your visitors, what is that plant?
Well, there is no room. I mean, these leaves are extending over the deep. And it's not a 4-inch pot.
Okay.
You know, not quite the size of one of those half barrels, but it's close.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, the bigger the container, the more soil insulating the roots, and the better it will help increase the success of overwintering, though you seem to do just fine. So I would continue doing what you're doing and enjoy a light harvest this year. And then you could do one in the fall right before, you know, we get our first killing frost.
Thank you so much. Melinda, can you tell me when your program is on?
Melinda's Garden Moment airs in the news segments at different stations. So if you go to my website to find...
Oh, I don't have a computer. I can't...
Oh, okay. And where? I'm sorry.
In Northern Illinois.
You're in Northern Illinois.
Lake Forest.
We are just now negotiating with a station in Chicago. On TMJ4, if you get the NBC affiliate out of Milwaukee, it's on Friday mornings. I'm usually on a show called Morning Blend through spring and summer, giving garden tips. And then they're also housed on my website as well.
Okay, Channel 4 in Milwaukee.
Yes, mm-hmm. The NBC affiliate. And it's usually Fridays in the news, Friday morning and Saturday morning.
And mm-hmm. What time would that be? About?
Like the 9 o'clock news.
Okay, and thank you so much.
Well,
I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And they're also housed on my website. And I just thought of one other idea for Mother's Day. And
good.
Serving, but if you are in southeast Wisconsin, I'm doing a series of garden walks at Berner Botanical Gardens. The proceeds benefit children's horticulture education. This will be the second walk of the year, and it's coming up May 18th. And we have a great time, 6:30 till everybody leaves me, and it's usually pretty dark by then. and this year we're going to see bulbs, I think, in spring. Last year it was so warm they were all done, and we looked at, you know, late spring blooming perennials and trees and shrubs. So whether you're mom or not, but I thought, you know, if you're looking for a gift and she likes to go on garden walks, support a good cause, kids' education, with the Friends of Berner and at the gardens. And if you're not in the area, I have it posted on my website. After the walk visit, we'll have photos of the plants, the handouts available, more information, so you can virtually take the walk with me as well.
That sounds great. And Melinda, and go to melindamyers.com, and Myers is M-Y-E-R-S.
Right. Thank you.
MelindaMyers.com. There you go. Let's go to Julie in Appleton. She has a question for you, Melinda. Hi, Julie.
Hey. Hi, Julie.
Hello. How are you today?
Great.
How are you?
Good. Very good. I have a question, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
While staying in Alabama earlier this spring, I saw a holly called Sky Pencil.
Oh, yes. It's gorgeous.
Familiar? Yes. Very familiar. I have heard that it is not hardy here. What do you think about that? Could it be coaxed along, do you think?
I think it's rated, if I remember right, either zone 6 or 7. I've seen it growing in, like, California and Oregon.
It is very cool, very narrow, very upright. I would say if you are, two things you might want to give a try, an east-facing location, which for any holly is a good idea, because with broadleaf evergreens, you want to protect them from winter wind and winter sun, very drying. You may want to try putting them in a container and then moving them to, you know, an unheated garage, maybe even, you know, an unheated garage or another little bit more protected spot. I would only do one if I was you. I haven't heard of anyone having success here in Wisconsin. If anyone has, let me know. I'd love to hear from you. That might, so I guess I would say it's for the those who are willing to take a risk and unfortunately maybe not be too successful. One of our good hollies, it's not narrow and upright, and it's not an evergreen, is the Winterberry or Michigan holly, Ilex verticillata. Great fruit in the winter. Likes acid soil, but I've seen it do okay in the alkaline soils of southeast Wisconsin. You get the holly berries, the birds love it. You just don't get that cool foliage or that neat growth habit. So, unfortunately, I like I said, if you want to experiment, but I would only try one and see if you have some success.
Mary in Watertown, we're on to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I bought some strawberry plants at Young's the other day, and they're all look nice, of course. But I wondered how long I need to condition them before I actually plant them, because we're still having freezing temperatures.
Yeah. Were these growing in a greenhouse when you purchased them?
That's my guess. You know, they're all in containers, and the plants look really nice, of course. And I know I have to cut, they're ever-bearing, and I have to cut off the blossoms and all that. And,
yeah.
And
what,
the berries, but I just, I mean, do I have...
And you bring up a good point, Mary, and I'm glad you asked this question, because I'm going to broaden it a little bit, if you don't mind, and I will answer your question. One of the things, a lot of nurseries and greenhouses grow perennials and fruit plants and things to get them up and growing, because you know what, we're more likely to buy them when they've got leaves on them and we know they're growing than the ones that are field grown, which, you know, it's kind of an act of faith just watching those little plants pop. Field-grown things or things that the nurseries and garden centers have outside, they've already conditioned them for us, and they're ready to go in the garden, but with some protection from frost usually. Things that are in a greenhouse do need, you know, at least a week to condition them. Here's what I like to do, and I have a house full of annuals I've been buying on my travels, so I think today is the day I'm going to start this myself. I like to use Rime, Harvest Guard, the floating row cover fabrics. And I put my plants in a sheltered location, cover them with that so that keeps them warm, and then I don't have to worry about frost and moving them in and out. It also breaks the light just a little bit. And then as I gradually get them used to, I can move them into more light, more light, more light. I have to tell you the funniest method I heard last weekend. I forget, I was out in Janesville, and this woman comes up and goes, well, let me tell you how I harden off my plants. She loads up an old pickup truck, puts all her plants there, moves it out on sunny days, moves it in the garage, saves her frost, puts it in shady areas, more sun, and saves a lot of work. I went, wow, what a great idea if you have room in your garage and a truck. Wagons work very well. I've had gardeners tell me they do that. So, you know, you can start getting them used to it. That Harvest Guard Rime, you could even cover the garden bed and warm up the soil, because cool soil is also an issue. So cover the garden with that now. Work on getting your plants used to more sunlight. You know, and in a week you could pop those out in the garden, leave the Rime on, and that'll speed up establishment and keep them warm and protect them from frost as well.
There you go. Thank you. Very much, Mary, for that call. Melinda Myers, our guest today on Garden Talk. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Melinda Myers, gardening expert extraordinaire, answering your questions today on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Melinda, we had a caller from Wazika who tried to plant the tomatoes in the topsy-turvy contraption last year, but nothing really happened. Do they work? What kind of soil is best to put in them? I tried it 2 years in a row. First year I had great success, put in new soil and that the next year and nothing.
You know, you're better than I, Larry. I won't even try them just because I know myself as a gardener. I do a lot of containers. I'm really good about watering every day. But topsy-turvies will work, but the key is water. There's such a small amount of potting mix in there that they dry out very quickly, and you have to water them a couple of times a day. I met a few people that have hooked up drip irrigation so that they just have to, you know, turn on the faucet quick, and they do it for sure. I've also met some gardeners. Well, actually, I read this in Birds and Bloom once. Someone had sent this in before topsy-turvies came out. They took a 5-gallon bucket, filled it with, cut a hole in the bottom, filled it with potting mix, planted their tomato, filled it with potting mix, and hung it. The problem is, the good part is, it's a lot more potting mix. It doesn't dry out as quickly. The bad news is it's really heavy.
Yes.
So, you know, to make sure your planter doesn't fall on the ground and crash, you need to have really good support. So the topsy-turvies work. I would use a slow-release fertilizer mixed in to the potting mix if your potting mix doesn't already have it, and then make sure you water thoroughly. So I think it's really key if you've got them by your front or back door where you're more likely to remember, you know, have a container of water. They're fun. It's kind of a fun way. I talked to the people who sell them, and I just said, you know, it's been a good way to get people excited about gardening, because I've met more people that grew their first tomato because of that. So, you know, and then now we just got to get them in the ground and in bigger pots. But yeah, if you do it, just watch the watering and watch your fertilization.
Arlene in New Berlin has a question for you, so we move to Arlene next. Hi there.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of questions to ask you, and then I'll take my answer off the air. One is on shrub roses. I have about 10 plants. I need to prune them. Is now a good time to prune them? Also, I have a honeysuckle vine on a arbor on my east side of the property, but the arbor is starting to lean, and I need to reposition it. Do I cut the honeysuckle down at the end of the growing season and start brand new, because the twining is absolutely wonderful? It looks like somebody weaved a basket. And so I really want to know what I should do with the honeysuckle, and I'll take my answers off the air.
Okay. All right.
Great. Well, let's start with shrub roses, because I think a lot of people will have that question. Yeah, if you can get out there and do your pruning, you know, we can prune even after things start to leaf out, but if we prevent the plant from putting out energy and then remove it and putting out more energy, it's better for the plant. With shrub roses, minimal pruning is the best thing to do. Just like we were talking about the climbing roses, we want to leave our shrub roses stand for winter. That increases their hardiness, plus you've got the rose hips for the birds and you to enjoy in the winter. Then in spring, remove a couple of the older stems. If they're big established plants, take out a couple of those big canes right back to the ground level, and that'll open it up so that new growth can occur. And then just prune back any winter damage tips and then shape as needed. Roses will tolerate severe pruning, because I know there are people out there going, well, I cut mine back to 3 or 4 inches and they do just fine. But what happens sometimes is all that stored energy pushes and you get a lot of growth coming back. And it's often not as stiff and upright and sturdy, and you often get more growth than you want. So by doing a little bit of pruning every year, spreads the workload over a long period of time, gives you good regrowth at a more manageable size. So that's what I do with the shrub rose. And the other thing for people with some of the knockouts, they are winter hardy, but you do sometimes need to be patient, and the less pruning you do on those, the better the hardiness. And then for honeysuckle, I was kind of chuckling because I had the same thing. My honeysuckle vine looked beautiful and kind of pulled the trellis over. did not have it supported well. And so my honeysuckle vine, I need to get my trellis up soon and reposition. You could do one of two things. If you can sturdy that trellis and enjoy one more season, it sounds like you like the way those stems twine around. Otherwise, get out there now and prune your honeysuckle. If it's an established plant, you can prune it back to a couple feet tall, you know, then prune off all that twining stems, reposition, secure your trellis, and then retrain your honeysuckle. You'll be amazed at how much growth you'll get this year, even after pruning it that severely. you're better off to prune in the spring. And, you know, it's just a matter of, do you want to do it this year or next year? It'll tolerate a fall pruning, but if you can do your work this spring, I'd get out there and get busy this weekend maybe and get it taken care of, repositioned, and train that vine back up there, and you'll still get blooms this year.
There you go. Janice in Grafton, your turn. Hi, Janice.
Hi. Hello, Melinda. Thank
Hi.
You for all you do.
Oh, thank you for calling.
I just bought some ranunculus this year for the first time, and I'm wondering what the companion plant would be if I put them on the southwest side of the garage.
So you did ranunculus, you said?
Yes.
Did I? Okay. And do you, what color are they? Are they like a? There's a couple of different kind of ranunculus. Are these the non-hardy?
I bought a yellow one, and then another one that's kind of like a fuchsia color.
And a fuchsia
yeah,
color.
And,
you looking for something?
Right now I have them in the house.
Okay. You looking for something taller to go with them? Behind?
Well, something that's would be a good like a. Or maybe a ground like a, around the edge of the barrel. I'm putting them in the barrel.
Oh, you're putting them in a container. Okay.
Yes.
A couple things. I'm a huge fan of Diamond Frost Euphorbia. It's light and airy. I call it the baby's breath of container gardens because it kind of fills in
mm-hmm.
as it goes. Nuremberges may complement or be too similar. I'm not sure. Nuremberges might. You know what would really be pretty is, I think, I mentioned them before, Angelonia, which is sometimes called summer. I think they're called summer snapdragons. They have somewhat upright, kind of spiky flowers, but light and airy in appearance.
Oh.
And that might complement. I think it's a different form, and you can get blues and whites. Those, I think, would be very pretty with your ranunculus.
Uh-huh.
Lobelia, if you do lobelia, a lot of gardeners who've used lobelia in the past know they kind of fade out in the heat of the summer. I think it's Techno as well as Laguna tend to be more heat-tolerant varieties, and it says that right on the tag.
Oh.
And those are a little bit trailing, so if you want something to trail over.
Well, lobelia
you know,
likes the shade, though.
Lobelia takes full sun, but the reason you probably put it in the shade is because of the heat issue.
Mm.
And I saw plantings of Laguna lobelia in full sun at the Green Bay Botanic Garden. It's been a few years ago. In full bloom in August.
Oh, how do you Laguna?
Laguna, like a you know, like the water lagoon, like a lagoon. Like Laguna Beach, I guess it is. L A G U N A, and then Techno, which is T E C, I think it's H N O, I think is another heat tolerant lobelia, and that might give you that trailing, and it's and they're more heat tolerant as well.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be, those might be, and then with the Angelonia, it might be a nice combo to repeat kind of the texture with your ranunculus still being the main feature in that container.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Janice. Appreciate your call. We had a caller from Green Bay would like to plant a nine-bark shrub. It says it needs full sun, but she has an east exposure spot that gets most of its light early in the day. Would that be sufficient?
The one problem that nine bark can have is powdery mildew, and so an east is usually better, you know, because if the foliage has gotten wet overnight, it tends to dry out. Make sure it has plenty of air circulation. I've seen them do pretty well in an east, and really in the summer, we've got, if it's unobstructed east, you really do get a good 6 to 8 hours of light in the summer, and it should be okay. Keep in mind, Diablo does get as big as the tag tells you. It's a big shrub, 8 feet or more. Summer wine, a little bit shorter. And there's a new one out called Little Devil. And it's a compact, so it has the smaller leaves that remind me almost of a spirea leaf, but they're purple. And it's a little bit shorter, 4 or 5, and narrow and upright, which might be not the same as that sky pencil holly, but at least it would be hardy here. and it does have the white with a pink tinge flower and then the little seed capsules. But Little Devil's got a nice, you know, for a shorter hedge would be very cool, so depending on the area. So you should be okay with that. Again, just watch moisture. Make sure you're not doing overhead watering. Fluctuating humidity is what causes powdery mildew. But as full sun in the morning, you should be okay. If it's obstructed, I'd find a new spot.
Got an email from Diane in, where was she from? She was from Cable, Wisconsin, who says that she's anxiously awaiting my return to Bayfield next week. for Bayfield in Bloom. Oh, I'm telling you, Melinda, it is so much fun.
Oh, excellent.
I've gone every year now for the past many, I don't know, 8-9 years, something like that, and we broadcast, do our Garden Talk show.
I heard you last year doing it, and I was very jealous.
I tell you, it is a lot of fun, and we broadcast from the Bayfield Pavilion, so we're right on Lake Superior shore there, and looking forward. It's always a big crowd for it, and I'm really looking forward to it. Judith Sears Poisson is going to be with us as well, so she's going to be there, and a lot of people will be meeting her for the very first time, so we're really looking forward to it.
You know, thank you for mentioning that. There are so many wonderful garden tours and events.
Yeah.
I mean, I think one of the wonderful things about Wisconsin is our tie to the environment and gardening. And, yes, I was listening to you, and it did sound gorgeous. And, you know, those are great events to go and get ideas from other gardeners and,
oh, absolutely.
You know, celebrate our summer that sometimes seems too short.
Yeah, absolutely. Melinda Myers, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Melinda Myers, Milwaukee-based gardening expert, TV host, and author. She's 30 years of horticulture experience. She's written 20 gardening books. She hosts the nationally syndicated Melinda's Garden Moments segments, which air on both TV and radio stations throughout the Midwest. Great to have her along. Thank you for listening in. And we have lots of callers online and lots of good information. Melinda, I wanted to mention that the Agriculture West Madison Research Station in Madison has a family horticulture day on May 14th. Actually, that's my birthday. On my birthday. And so that's from 10 in the morning to 2 in the afternoon. Bring the whole family. You can learn how to develop a backyard kitchen garden in a small space. They got a variety of activities to get the kids going and spark their interest. And they've got purple, red, and yellow potatoes, red popcorn, green caterpillars, and all kinds of things.
They also, I was lucky enough to be on a program in Green Bay speaking to the master gardener or community gardeners up there. And Bruce, and I apologize, who works there, was sharing an idea of doing a bee house out of a bucket and bamboo. It was really great. I'm going to try to take his idea and put it into practice at our garden at We Energies, Energy Park at State Fair. It was so interesting, and he had some really good practical advice on bringing native bees to pollinate your garden and some simple fun things. So I'm sure he's going to have some of that out there happening. And boy, you're right. I can't make it on the 14th. I'll be thinking of you. Happy birthday, Larry. But boy, it is a great resource, and we're so lucky to have that here in Wisconsin. So it's worth the trip, even if you're not in town. So thanks for mentioning that.
Yeah, and they're open during the entire growing season. This is from dawn to dusk, so you can go out there almost any time. But this kind of a family fun day, which sounds like an awful lot of fun.
Oh, it does.
Sarah in St. Mary Point, Minnesota, has a comment or question. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thank you for having me on air.
Sure.
Appreciate it. I just had a half a truckload of compost dropped, so I'm ready for spring.
Good.
then I just planted some French lingerie reblooming daylily, so I'm kind of excited about that.
Great.
My question is, I kind of picked up a Meyer lemon tree on the way back from Florida.
Okay.
Not expecting it to do anything, but this winter it bloomed prolifically, and now it has these little lemons on it, the largest ones the size of an olive. So I'm wondering, is this going to go any further? And if so, what do I do with it?
You know, first pat yourself on the back and enjoy. You know, Meyer lemon is the best one to start with for anyone that wants to try to do citrus indoors. The risk of moving it in and out is bugs and the transition, adjusting from the low light to the high light back to the low light. But you get such a good boost of energy that it's wonderful for your plant. Keeping the soil evenly moist so that you don't end up with problems in terms of dropping the fruit. Is it pretty heavy production, or is it fairly light?
Pretty heavy.
Okay.
I'm surprised. There must be at least 8 lemons on there.
Okay. You might want to thin that out as well, and, you know, if there's a lot of them. But if they're evenly spaced over, then you may want to just, you know, just leave them as is, but watch your moisture. Avoid high nitrogen fertilizers. You know, have you been fertilizing all winter, or
just a little bit?
Okay, yeah. Then you should be good with that. Is the leaves looking good? Nice, dark green and solid.
Pretty good. At first, they started to fall off.
Okay.
And so then I was lucky that some stayed on, but then all these blossoms came.
Oh, and doesn't it smell great? I think the other thing about
citrus, how fragrant it was.
Yeah. So, no, I think continue to do what you're doing. If the plants, the leaves look a little bit of pale, very dilute solution of any flowering house plant fertilizer. If you've got a good sunny spot, you might want to just leave it there. If you do move it out, gradually introduce it to the sunlight, just like you would any other plant, and then back in. But that's, you know, with the fruit on it, that sometimes can be a transition that's a little tough for the plant to take, and you may lose your fruit. But mm-hmm. the plant will do fine.
There you go. Thank you very much for
calling. And let us know how they get. Let us know the size of your harvest. That's cool.
Yeah, they don't get really big.
No, but it's a lemon grown in Wisconsin.
Yeah,
right.
Jeff in Chicago has a question for you. Let's go to Jeff. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
Good. I'm trying to establish a lawn in my yard in Chicago. About 7 years ago, I planted a big linden tree in the middle of the yard, so I had a lot of shade. But through the years, we've pruned it, and it's pretty tall now, so we're getting a lot of sun. Last year, I removed a big yew bush in the corner of the yard, so it's a bigger area. I have 2 young kids, and I put a water line in. 2 years ago, I put seed down in straw and rototilled. It really didn't take very good, and last year, I bought shade sod,
okay,
and I put that in. And, you know, the kids are on it at times. Maybe we didn't water enough, but I'm going to try it again this year, and I wanted to know, I mean, obviously have as little traffic on it as possible.
Right.
But do you recommend any type of fertilizer, peat moss? Should I use seed or should I use sod? And any pointers on, because I know once I get a lawn established, I'll be good, but it's really hard with the 2- and 6-year-old.
Oh, yeah. And so it sounds like it's pretty bare. What you seeded is bare, I mean, to the point where you might as well start over, because I hear.
Exactly.
Okay. How is your soil in that area? Is it?
I think it's good. It's real dark black soil. I've never had it analyzed. But
okay.
I mean, everyone has good lawns there. It's just, you know, because we had so much shade there.
Right.
And now there's a lot of traffic. It's almost like a little baseball field out there.
Okay. What you may want to do, and you're going to have to decide, you may want to decide the areas where you may want to do some sodding because you're going to have instant lawn. The problem with instant lawn is you've got all this top growth, minimal roots, so you really have to get it, you know, watered in and going. But you will get a quicker lawn, which may help. But again, you're right, with all that traffic, you may want to seed the areas that are really heavily, because you still have some shade, right? It's better, but there's still some shade there.
I would call it a shady yard, but it's not heavy shade
okay.
now, because the trees are pretty high. There's a lot of trees. You know, my neighbor has trees, they're on the south, conifers.
Okay. So here's, you may want to just prep the soil, you know, make sure that you prepare the top 6 inches, at least loosen it up since you've had, you know, get the dead stuff off, till that up. If it's nice and it's got lots of organic matter, you're fine. Otherwise, you might want to add some compost or aged manure to that area. The benefit of seeding is you have a lot more choices than sod. You know, sod, full sun, great. Some of the shade sod's better. But you might want to get a durable mix that's shade tolerant. And durable mixes have more ryegrass that's quick to recover. So all that traffic. And get it seeded. You know, and I don't know if it's even possible if you did a section now and kept the kids off and maybe mulched or something the other area for them to play on. And then in late August do the other area, and then by then the grass might be a little more established. I don't know with your yard if that's possible. Or maybe sodding the more sunny areas and then seeding the more shady areas and trying, you know, to limit access or get the kids to spread out. And I know they're kids and grass is a good thing for them, you know, to spread that out. But seeding is going to give you a lot more options for different kind of seed sources. There's a lot of new seeds out there that have coated materials that help hold the moisture near the seed so they germinate better. And many of them have little crystals that tell you when you need to water, so it's a good clue that way.
Do you recommend strawing the top?
Some kind of mulch, whether straw, depending on how large the area is, Remay Harvest Guard. There are cellulose-type mulches like pen mulch. And then these little encapsulated seeds are kind of the mulch and the seed all in one. Mm-hmm. So you need something to help hold the moisture so you're not watering as often.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
You
know, I have an area in front, if this makes you feel better, the area, I have very little grass between my sidewalk and curb, but between the leaves dumped from when they, you know, plow and neighbors haven't taken their leaves out and soon enough end up on my grass and somebody scalping it. It's, you know, I'm always struggling with the same thing every year, trying to get the grass to beat the weeds, and I choose not to use chemicals. So, you know, every year it's like I'm going to take care of it this year. I'm continually overseeding, and I'm starting to gain ground. I have kids from the park walk across, but nothing like two kids actively playing on the grass. So I would just, once you can get it down, and then you may need to overseed for a few years to build it up. But I think try that grass seed first, and if you can try to do it in sections maybe, that might help too, or at least overseed in sections.
Good luck.
Thank you so much, and I'm going to give it one more shot now.
Good, okay, and your kids will appreciate it.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for calling. Rick in Salem, Wisconsin, has a question for you. Hi, Rick.
Good day to you. How are you?
Good.
Hey, God bless all the gardeners, and let's have a protective year.
Oh, yes.
Sorry if I'm saying that.
Oh, thank you.
I have a question. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just agreeing with you. Thanks.
Okay. I have a question about rhubarb. I moved into my new house about 6 years ago. I took some of the roots from my old house and placed them in, you know, our new area for the rhubarb garden. We had like four fabulous years of a crop. Now the last year I had a good crop, a good fruit, but I started getting a blight, you know, and it's kind of a rusty color blight on the leaves.
Yes, there's a Cercospora leaf spot disease that will knock it down. One of the things I found is it's somewhat weather. You know, we had a lot of rain last year. I found it on rhubarb I've grown in the past, and I find a good cleanup if you can harvest off, you know, the leaves that are damaged early to prevent it from spreading as soon as it appears without devastating the whole plant, okay? And then definitely a good cleanup in the fall. Rhubarb's so low maintenance and so hardy that it's often one that, you know, it's kind of like, it's fine, and you do the cleanup in the spring. But if you can do that cleanup in the fall, you know, after the frost kills the top, cut the leaves back to ground level, and then, you know, get rid of them, and that'll help reduce the problem, too. Fungicides may or may not be effective. You want to make sure it's labeled for use on rhubarb, and then the period between, you know, of applying. It usually shows up, I find, at least usually after the harvest, later in the season, and the plants can look pretty straggly by the end of the year.
Right.
So, you know, if it did suffer last year, a low-nitrogen, slow-release fertilizer, so you don't push a lot of nitrogen, which can push a lot of growth that's more susceptible to disease, may help just kind of replenish some of that lack of vigor due to that early leaf loss last year.
Mm-hmm.
But let's hope, you know, who knows with this weather this year what we're going to see. I kind of tried to cheat and look on Brian's website to see if he had any clues for me before I came on. So that's always a good place, too, to check to see what's happening around the state.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I thought, you know, I had some problems with a bunch of my Paxandras in the area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're maybe 35, 40 feet away from that that planting of the rhubarb, you know, and they got a blight. And I use like a
chlorothalonil or something, or Daconil.
Yeah, I use a Daconil or something like that, and that kind of cleans things up, you know.
And that's a different leaf spot, a leaf and stem spot that is common. You need to check. Different diseases respond differently to different chemicals. So check the label before you use it on your rhubarb. And they're usually done preventatively. And I'm sorry I interrupted. I got so excited. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You know, just make sure it's labeled for use on a food crop and for rhubarb, because chemicals on some plants can be perfect and control the disease, and sometimes can even damage other plants. And then when you get into food stuff, you should always be careful, but even more so when you're going to eat something. I'm not sure it's labeled for that use, so check on the label. It'll tell you if it is labeled for that use and application rates.
There you go. Good luck, Rick.
Thanks
Thank you
a lot.
Thanks for calling. I had an email from Terry in Milwaukee. Terry says, I work in a very industrial area of Milwaukee. I drive a long road passing cyclone fences and railroad tracks, rather bleak. I had the idea to drop some sunflower seeds in the fence lines and abandoned fields. Doesn't look like anybody sprays or mows the fence lines. I envision the drive into work in late summer with sunflowers greeting us as we come to work. Is this a good or a bad idea?
And Terry, I know who you are, and I've been posted this on my Facebook as well, and I was reluctant to answer. I totally understand what she's trying to do, and guerrilla gardening is very popular in New York, where people are going in and planting abandoned, vacant areas. I'm sure there's probably some law against it. So, I don't want to get that call from jail, though I will come bail you out, Terry. You know, I think those are such fun things. I'm going to do this with the daycare where my grandkids are on a very busy street, and we're looking at the fence and talking to the teachers about growing some sunflowers to make it nice and cheery and just add to those people driving by on a busy street. I know people who do it. That's all I can say, and I can't name names.
All right. Well, let's see. Phyllis in Brookfield might have a question that isn't quite so angst-producing here. Let's go to Phyllis. Hi, Phyllis.
Hello, this is Phyllis from Brookfield, and I always enjoy Melinda's advice, expert advice.
Thank you.
And today I wonder about my peonies. They're starting to push through, and I transplanted them about 3 years ago. I wonder what the best fertilizer is for them. And then I have a trumpet vine that's starting to get a little leaf in the wooden part, and I wonder, should I trim back the canes to encourage it?
Good questions. Peonies are pretty tough, and if your soil's good, minimal fertilizing, if any, is needed. So if you've amended your soil, I lived in a home where the neighbor her father had transplanted the peonies at that home like 100 years earlier. Very cool. So, you know, they've lived in the same spot with minimal care. The thing you want to be careful with any flowering plant is, again, a low nitrogen, so you don't push leaf growth at the expense of flowers. Pretty tough plants, so they need minimal. I did just wanted to mention some research on Milorganite, which is Wisconsin's own, that they found that it has only 2% phosphorus. It's non-leaching, so it's not banned because it doesn't leach. But what they found is when microorganisms work on the fertilizer, it releases phosphorus and potassium. Milorganite doesn't have any. That's locked up in our soil, and we tend to have high excessive levels and make it available to the plant. So you get that phosphorus the plant needs for blooming and root development without adding phosphorus to the soil, which causes other problems. So a low nitrogen. For your trumpet vine, don't fertilize. Trumpet vines steal nutrients wherever they can get it, and they'll grow, and not flower if they get too much nitrogen. Now's a good time to prune them. Mine usually dies back. The tips usually die back over winter, plus they are reaching into my neighbors. At first I thought one of those questions might be about me with the trumpet vine. I'm going out there today. Pruning now is a great idea to keep it back in line and in check if it's overgrowing the space.
Right. Oh, great. Thank you for your help.
Thanks a lot, Phyllis.
Thanks, Phyllis. And a caller from New Richmond who has free-ranging chickens that love scratching up the mulch around her plants. Any way to discourage them, or are they just doing what chickens are supposed to do?
You know what? I think I have to get better on chickens and goats, Larry, because as I'm traveling, those are two trends that a lot of gardeners around the country are taking up. And so I'm going to have to plead not the best expert. Chickens do tend to scratch and look and do, so I'm thinking that's going to be an issue. I know some places where they actually use chickens to do
weed control. In Oklahoma, I was at an extension garden where they had a huge fenced area, a garden in the middle, and kind of a runway, and they released the chickens, and they, you know, they were doing experiments on the weed control. So if you can train them, I guess it's okay, but if they're disturbing your mulch, not so good. So I will do my homework. I guess it's a sign I need to learn more about chickens and goats now.
Okay. Well, here's an email from Becky. My Leonard Maisel magnolia
is
blooming more sparsely than the first 2 years. It's getting full sun. Does it need sulfur fertilizer?
You know, magnolias like moist, well-drained soils. I've had several people tell me that they've seen their magnolias not be as prolific this year. Sometimes on certain plants, we get a big push of bloom, and then the next year, it's a little bit lighter, then the next year, bigger, sometimes using up the energy. Sometimes that's common. Be careful not to over-fertilize. A sulfur will help with the pH if you're seeing, but that wouldn't be bloom as much as it would be chlorotic yellowing of the leaves. Mulch and proper watering is the key for your magnolias. And last year with our flooding and drought, we often have some root dieback, and it takes the plants a while to recover even if they survive the drought. It could be that kind of effect. Again, if you were going to do something, I'm just a big fan of low nitrogen. It just reduces your risk of overdoing it, gives the plants little bits over a long period of time if it's slow release, which is really good way to fertilize your plants. So if you do that and use an organic fertilizer, they tend to be a little more acidic too. Sulfur is an option, but usually not going to have that big of an impact on the pH without damaging the surrounding plant. So I might just kind of wait and see what happens and see how that plant leaves out.
And I got an email from Tom Zinnen, who's involved with the Family Horticulture Field Day at the West Madison Station, and he said, oh, we have lots of outdoor displays and tours. Got a bottle biology miniature garden, beauty and the beets.
That's great.
Yeah, they'll be extracting some DNA glop from wheat germ, and they've got a cabbage juice pH indicator, and they're looking at different kinds of what makes the best popcorn, and they're... Oh, let's see, cranberries. I got something about cranberries and insect ambassadors. So they've got a lot of things going on. That's a week from tomorrow, actually. It's on my birthday, actually May 14th.
You can help Larry celebrate by going there. And it's, you know what's cool is if you get kids excited about gardening, somebody got all of us excited. We need to do that for the next generation. But they're more likely to eat better. Research shows less problems with ADHD. Girls are more confident in a landscape setting. Project Evergreen website has a lot of these details on the economical and social and environmental issues, the benefits of landscaping. So, you know, take your kids out and have a good time. And kids of all ages, I still have a good time at those kids' events.
And you've lots of stuff on your, in the last 30 seconds here, at your melindamyers.com.
Right. We have questions and frequently asked questions, video and audio tips, podcast or archive there, photo galleries, anything we can do to try to help you, we like to do. So if you don't find it there, let me know and we'll see if we can help you out.
And that's Melinda Myers, MYERS.com. Melinda, it's always a great pleasure. Thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you.
You too, Larry. Thanks a lot.
Melinda Myers, our guest, and certainly take a look at her website, melindamyers.com. It's just packed with great information. And again, that's melindamyers.com, and Myers is MYERS.com. We'll have her back for sure, and we will have a show on Monday as well. Rick Seedy of faircompare.com will be stopping by to give us some advice on planning for summertime travel. And it's the 150th anniversary of the start of the Civil War, a new book out on it we'll talk about. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.